Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10x points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Holla talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com, designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking about being a small but mighty real estate investor with Chad Carson.
Right, we are so pumped to be talking with our friend Chad Carson, aka Coach Carson, which is also his site, coachcarson.com. Holdover from Chad's Clemson football playing days. So one of my earliest memories was hanging out with Chad in the pool at FinCon nearly 5 years ago. We're talking real estate. We were enjoying a craft beer. And here we are at it again. But just because this feels like a more casual conversation to us, that does not mean that Chad isn't going to bring the goods. We, Joel, you and I, we tout the merits of small-time real estate investing. But Chad has made it his mission, and it's the focus of his new book, The Small and Mighty Real Estate Investor. So if you're wondering how owning a few investment properties, how that could get you closer to financial freedom, well, keep listening. If you're wondering if it's even possible to get into real estate, given where mortgage rates are currently, this episode is for you. Chad, thank you so much for talking with us today here on the podcast.
Matt, Joel, it is great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Chad, you're welcome anytime, like next week also. So we'll bring you back on again. Yeah.
Let's do it.
There really is a lot to cover. We probably could have multiple episodes with you just because the book is so thorough. But the first question we ask anybody who comes on the show is, what do you like to splurge on? It lets us know a little bit about you and your priorities. But Matt and I, we, of course, have the big priority of spending more on craft beer. What's that in your life?
That was one of the first things I resonated with you guys on, both listening to you and also meeting you, is, yeah, food and craft beer are, like, my wife and I, we like to combine that with travel. I guess that would be my, like, kind of cheat answer, that we like, my wife and I, when we first met on our first date, it was like, where are we going to go? Where are we going to travel? And nice. So from there, though, I think just not, you know, on a car, we drive an old Toyota, we drive old, you know, hand-me-down cars from family members. That's okay with us, but going to really nice locations, having good food, like in Spain or Greece, or that's the best. Like we really enjoy that. And then having a good craft beer is right up there with it as well.
Okay, so I was detailing my first date with my wife recently to one of my kids, and I ended up taking my wife. We went to the zoo and to a baseball game, which is like a really, really long date, right? Yeah. But you, I feel like you blew me out of the. You guys were talking about going on trips together on your first date?
Like six months from now.
That sounds intense, Chad.
Yeah, I mean, we were out hiking, and we were like, well, what do you like to do? Like, what are you up to? And it was just like one thing after another. She's like, well, I traveled to Guatemala. I speak Spanish. She's a Spanish teacher, by the way. And for me, I was kind of itching to travel because I played football in college, and I did a little bit of study abroad, but I was just like, I never got to do enough of it. So I was just really intrigued by that. And it's like, well, that's exactly what I want to do. I would love to go to Latin America. I would love to learn Spanish. She's like, well, I'm a Spanish teacher. I was like, well, perfect. You can give me lessons. That's great.
More time together. Yeah, yeah. I guess we'll go ahead and get married.
Yeah, let's do it.
Well, on that note, so you just got back from another year abroad. What made you go specifically to Spain? Can you share something about that trip? How the heck was it?
Yeah, well, I mentioned the Spanish language. That's sort of something that we connect with. We've lived in Ecuador in the past for about a year and a half with our kids. So that was an amazing experience. We love Ecuador. We love South America. We wanted to try something in Europe where we could be a little closer. We kind of had this vision of my kids were 10 and 8 when we left. And actually, a little bit, 11 and 9. I can't get that right. But I wanted to take them to historical sites. And Europe is just so dense with so many different places. And so like we went from Spain was our home base. They went to school there. They were speaking Spanish in school, which was amazing. We were in a small community in Granada in the southern part of Spain. But then we also took side trips. So we went to Greece in February and went to see like the Parthenon and all these old sites. And that was like a history lesson in person. Yeah, that diversity of just experience, history, stories, just was, I think all of that together was an amazing experience.
Talk to us about the logistics and the finances of pulling off a big stunt like this. What sticks out in your mind as kind of the biggest barriers, the biggest hurdles that you had to overcome to kind of pull off a year in a foreign country?
Basically, this is like a mini retirement,
right?
Like a yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I first did this back in 2009, my wife and I didn't have kids at that point. We just had to save money. So like, that's how we did it first time. We went for 4 months. We saved the money. It was almost like saving for a car and just paying cash for a car. That's the way we looked at it. And instead of buying a new car, we spent $20,000 on a trip and travel. This time around, you know, it was just a much different situation. We have rental income coming in from the United States. And so, you know, paying for all of our lifestyle expenses in Spain basically came from the distributions from our rental property partnership that I have back in the United States. And so the money side of things was less challenging, although I know for a lot of people, that's going to be the biggest challenge, just getting the money. But the other big challenge, which is part of the story of why I wrote the Small Mighty Investor, was that the time and the flexibility to be able to go for a year is probably the most difficult thing, because you have obligations, you have to be in a certain location. And so for me and I have a rental property business, and having property managers on the ground doing most of the day-to-day work. I have a college student rentals, so they were leasing properties for me while I was gone, and me paying them to do that and having systems and processes, like all of that is something that's really important. But with a typical job, you can't do that. It's a lot harder to do that. You mm-hmm. might have a, you know, digital nomad kind of is becoming more of a thing, but being able to travel abroad is more, you know, having the time and flexibility in addition to the money. And so those two things combined, I think, were the biggest challenges.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. And I kind of hinted at this when I said like the mini retirements, but you are all about creating these awesome experiences just all along the way, not just saving the best trips for retirement, right? when you're actually less able to actually enjoy it. Why is do more of what matters so core to your philosophy and how you view life?
Yeah, I feel like everybody knows it's easy to quantify how to make money. Like you save money, it's not easy to do, but it's easy to quantify. You save a bank account, it's on your statement, like it's pretty easy to measure. And even with time, like we know we want free time, but to me, like the good stuff, like as a parent right now with kids, like the good stuff are those small moments, those in-between times, like picking my kids up from school and they tell me something that they might not have told me if I was busy working somewhere, or going on a trip and seeing their eyes light up when they're seeing something for the first time in Greece, some big, huge temple, or just the small moments, like just being present, like doing what matters means it's totally different to different people. It might be serving in your community. It might mean taking care of a loved one, like all these things, which we know matter to us. They do require money sometimes because we got to pay the bills. We got to pay our mortgage payment. So usually work and our time gets spent doing that. But it most of all requires time. It requires presence. And so for me, the small mighty investor idea is like, you can go big and get huge and have all this money, but what if it takes away your time? What if it takes away your presence and doing those things that matter? Like, why would you do that? Like, what's the point? Why not have like a more balanced approach where you make enough money, because money is important, but you have like the ultimate currency, which is that time to do those things that you know are really the most important thing to you.
Yeah, agreed. And all right, let's talk about real estate, Chad, because that's your book obviously is influenced about that ultimate desire to have more free time, to do more of what matters. But specifically tell us why real estate, right? Why not just continue to sock money into index funds and tax advantaged accounts? That's what a lot of personal finance enthusiasts talk about. Like, that's the easy way. Real estate seems a little more difficult.
Yeah, I mean, they're all good. I want to say that up front. Like, I like index funds. I like savings accounts. I like all that stuff, which is what's so cool about your show, is that you combine a lot of different tools and show how they all work. But I'll make the pitch for real estate investing if this is something that somebody, if you're interested in it, because I think I don't like to try to talk people into real estate, because it's kind of like a startup business, where on the front end, you've got to learn a lot. You've got to build relationships. You've got to invest some time and knowledge and energy into it. But on the back end, it can become a very passive, kind of like a blue chip stock type of investment. So that front end, that front loaded kind of investment of time and energy, though, is important to know. So, like, that's why I don't want to talk people into it. But if you're willing to put that energy and that effort and that money up front, real estate has this unique quality. And a friend of mine, Jillian Johnsrud, who you guys probably know as well, she always says that real estate money, it spends differently in early retirement or in financial independence. It spends differently. So, like, think about if you had $1 million or $500,000 in a stock investment account, or if you had a 401k, like, taking your principal out of there to live off of that principal is just a different psychological decision than getting rental income that comes in every single month, and you still have the property. Like, you're not selling the property, but you get this rental income coming in. And I've experienced this firsthand, because I'm living in Spain. We spend 100% of the money some months, because we're traveling and doing all this stuff. And guess what? Like, next month, another set of money comes in, and then another set of money. And so that recurring income of real estate is a super important thing. And it's more than just math. Like, the math's important too, but having recurring income that you can also get to be semi-passive. So it's not gonna be 100% passive, but I spend a couple hours per week now that my real estate investment portfolio is mature. I'm not buying and selling properties. I'm not remodeling properties. We're just managing the managers, basically. And I say, if you have a few properties, that could be like 30 minutes a week, 4 hours a month. Like, that's not exaggeration. Like, I've surveyed a lot of people I know who had those kind of portfolios. And so it could be very passive while also producing that recurring income, which, when you want to live off your income, when you want to live off your wealth, real estate investing gives you that ability to do it. In addition to all the other stuff you probably heard about, of building wealth and, you know, using leverage and having small amount of money down, like, that's all true too. But then also, real estate is an amazing financial independence kind of core vehicle to help you get there and live off your income.
Well, if we're talking about early financial independence, it's also not age restricted like some of those tax advantaged retirement accounts are, right? Like,
correct.
If you're putting it into a traditional 401k or IRA, you're not allowed to really touch that stuff without penalties until 59 and a half. And so real estate, it's like, boom, you get to kind of that recurring dividend on, you know, an ongoing basis.
Yeah, and it also has tax advantages. It's not quite as good as like a Roth IRA or something like that, but, you know, you can grow in a tax advantage way using things like depreciation, which shelters your income. So you don't pay quite as much in taxes as you would if you just got the income without depreciation. You know, this is something that people, even before retirement accounts were around, like, people have been using real estate and rental income as like a core retirement vehicle, as a core wealth building vehicle, because of all these various benefits that it has.
Yeah. In addition to the psychological win that comes with being able to enjoy the profit from the properties that thing is shedding every single month. You know, we've talked about the small and mighty approach with our listeners before. This is something we have adopted ourselves when it comes to how it is that we look at real estate. But for listeners out there who maybe haven't heard your philosophy, can you share specifically why going small, how it is that can be the right choice for a lot of folks?
Yeah, I'll tell it with a story. Like, when I first started real estate investing, I was 23 years old. I just graduated from college, and every class I went to, and I'm kind of dating myself now, so it was 21 years ago. Like, I was listening to like CDs back in the car, like riding around, you know.
That's how we did it back in the days,
yeah,
right?
Back in the tapes before that. I was also listening to tapes, but anyway, I was listening to these, and the ethos, or the main message you got most of the time, was, hey, you should get bigger and bigger and bigger, and you should grow faster and faster and faster. In fact, the most successful people are the people who get the biggest and grow the fastest. That's just the, it's just sort of an unwritten assumption. And so I sort of bought into that. And my business partner and I, during the first 3, 4, 5 years, were on that track. We were trying to get bigger, buy a lot of properties. But the end result of that was, number one, we hit the 2007-8-9 recession. And that was pretty scary, you know, having to try to survive that when you've grown fast and you have a lot of leverage. So that was one problem, is that there's a risk of growing fast. But then the other thing we realized, going back to that conversation about time, is that a smaller, simpler, slower, I call it like a tortoise-like real estate investing strategy, is actually super effective too. And it also gives you more of that time and flexibility that we talked about, where if you're constantly always growing, and I'm not saying you shouldn't push it and work hard and do those kinds of things, but if you never take a break, like I look at it like climbing a mountain, like if you're always climbing and you never take like some plateaus to take a break and take a breath and relax, then you're going to not enjoy the process. You're not going to enjoy the reason you're investing in the first place. You're going to not miss those opportunities with your family, with your friends. And so we realized in that moment, what we started writing down, like in 2007, when we were in the kind of the eye of the hurricane, we were like, all right, what is it we got into investing in real estate for? Like, why are we doing this? We bought like dozens and dozens of properties in the last year. And we wrote down things like, I wanted to travel, like with my future wife who I just met. I wanted to be present with friends. I wanted to play basketball in the middle of the day. I wanted to go hiking because we live in Clemson, South Carolina, near a bunch of the foothills of the mountains. So the things I wrote down on my list, some of them required money, like travel requires some money, but the biggest impediment to me doing the things that I wanted to do in my life was free time and flexibility. And that was such an aha moment. I was like, all right, we need to build a real estate investing philosophy, a business that works it backwards from those lifestyle things that the reason we're doing in the first place, so that we don't miss out on the whole benefit of why we even started this in the first place. And that I didn't call it that at the time, but the end result was having a leaner, slower business. And the more I got into it, the more I studied people who have done this. I met people who had 5 properties who were the most relaxed people enjoying life I've ever seen in my life, or people with 10 properties and they make enough money, but they don't have the kind of the weight and the struggle and the stress of going big. And it inspired me to try to do that with our own business and help other people do it as well.
Yeah, well, there's a focus there where you're optimizing for life as opposed to optimizing your real estate, like optimizing your portfolio. And I'm going to side with optimizing for life every single time.
Yeah, and you're working back from what matters to you, and then you're saying, cool, how do I fund that lifestyle?
How do I achieve that?
Yeah, and so many people are doing the opposite, or they just haven't thought enough about what they want their life to look like. And so they're like, well, I guess real estate is the ticket to wealth. And then so they keep pursuing that, and they go so dang hard that they're missing out on the benefits that real estate could afford. You actually, in your book, you highlight 3 different couples, and you're like, this couple is making just plenty of money from their real estate portfolio, but they've got the flexibility to go along with it, whereas somebody else might have 1,000 units. They've got this job, this thing they've got to get back to. Do you want to kind of like talk about those couples and that kind of scenario you set up in your book and how you think about it?
Yeah, the story was, I'll simplify it a little bit. There's a couple, Liz and Tom. They live in St. Louis, Missouri, but they could be anywhere in the United States, right? But they had this simple 10 property portfolio. And 15 years after they started, they bought these properties like in the first 5 or 6 years, and then they worked on paying them off. Like they actually paid off the debt on their properties, and they owned 10 single family houses free and clear. And just to kind of simplify the numbers, when they paid all of their expenses, like taxes, insurance, maintenance, all that stuff, they had no mortgage payment anymore. More, and they made $1,000 per property or $10,000 per month. So $10,000 per month, like think about what you can do with $10,000 a month. And if that's not your number, maybe you only need $5,000 or $15,000, whatever your number is. But the point was, like 10 properties produced $10,000 per month, and they were paid off. And they were friends with another couple who had kind of got a different path, which is sort of the traditional path these days. If you listen to real estate investor, people talking about it, they went and they got big because they were so good at real estate investing that they said, why should I just stop at my own properties? Like I could go partner with other people and raise money. And they bought bought thousands of units with a bunch of other people's money. But the reality of the situation in this story was that they were taking a trip together, and the couple who had all the thousands of units, they had to go back to the United States. They couldn't extend their trip because they had remodel projects going on. They had a team, you know, one of their team members like quit, and they had to go try to replace that person. And so on paper, it looked like they had systems and team, and supposedly it was passive. But when you have this big operation with lots of people and lots of things going on, it's like a machine. There's always something breaking, and there's always something you got to put your attention on. And so what I advocate for, what I think this story shows, is kind of like time management. Like, you can try to manage your time by doing like hundreds of things and having like organizers and to-do lists and all that stuff. And you can try, you know, systematize all that. You know, that's one way to do it. Or you could just do less stuff. Like, you could just not do as many things every day, and your life would be a lot simpler. And real estate investing is the same way. Like, you got to find a happy medium where, yeah, you got to get enough properties to pay your your goals, like pay for things, to build enough wealth. But there's a happy medium in there. And I think the small and mighty model says, you know, you can get to 5 properties, 10 properties, 20 properties. You can get bigger if you want, depending on what your goals are. But instead of using the cash to continue getting more and more and more, eventually you reach this stage, which I call in the book the ender stage, where you've built enough wealth to start actually plowing the money back, and to use a poker metaphor, like to start taking some chips off the table and actually paying off some debt and simplifying your life. And you don't have to pay off all your properties, but like actually paying off debt's kind of sacrilegious in the real estate world. Like, people don't talk about that. They go, oh, you can't pay debt off. Like, what are you talking about? That's not, you can't. Only Dave Ramsey does that. It's like, no, you can actually, you can do it too. Like, it's actually a reasonable thing to do.
Well, we want to talk more about that, how you sold some properties. We want to talk about some of the other factors you consider when you are looking at properties and how we should be responding to rising interest rates as well. We will get to all of that right after this.
Cachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Cachava really earns their 52,000 plus 5-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in 5 delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Cachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Cachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the AM in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Cachava. Just go to Cachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's Cachava.com/howtomoney. Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. And now a word from the show's sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry, Betterment is here to help.
Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again.
Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
I
All right, we're back from the break. We're still talking with our good friend Chad Carson about real estate investing, but kind of taking a different approach than most people advocate for these days. And Chad, can you actually maybe hop in the time machine a little bit? You were talking about when you used to listen to tapes, so maybe your brain is already there. But about how you got into real estate in the first place, because you actually made a quick pivot in the beginning. House hacking is part of that story. I'd love for you to tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, I was listening to tapes. That's true. And it was back when I was 23 years old, but I graduated from college. I was a biology major. I thought I was going to go to med school. And I was like, all right, I'm just going to take a break for a year or two and just do this like entrepreneurship thing. And I actually started trying to flip houses. So, you know, in real estate, you could have the rental property business, which is what I do now. And a lot of people do. And you can do this part-time on the side. Whereas what I was doing was going out looking for deals, finding fixer-upper properties, foreclosures. I would try to get them at a really low price. And then my business partner and I would flip them, either fixing them up and selling them or just reselling them to another investor. So that's how I put food on the table. Like, that was my job. And once I started doing that for a year, I kind of forgot about med school and said, I'm just going to do this thing on my own. And I don't want to go the traditional path anymore.
I'll make more money than a doctor anyway.
Yeah, well, maybe not. I don't think I think I would have made more money. I didn't do that well, but I've survived and I had a lot of fun and I played pickup basketball in the middle of the day. So that I met my goals.
There you go.
I also, you know, in the early years, like anytime you start something new, like your housing expense is a big deal. And so I quickly learned that about this strategy where you can move into a property and rent out part of the property that you live in, called house hacking today. And I actually bought a fourplex, and I'm in a college town, Clemson. And so we had these little small multifamily properties, and this one happened to be pretty close to Clemson's campus. And so, but it was a major fixer upper. Like, in fact, I showed up, the property was vacant and it had Merry Christmas spray painted across the front of the whole building. Like somebody like tagged it in the middle of the night. And I walked into unit 4, and there was an outline of a chalk outline of a body in unit number 4. And I'm like, okay, I don't know that I can do this.
Wow.
And but my I had a mentor, luckily, who was like, no, that's perfect. That's exactly what you want. You know, you want it to look horrible that nobody else wants this property. And I said, all right, I guess I'll do this. And so I fixed that property up. I had to borrow money to do it, but I moved into unit number 2. And I rented all the other 3 units out, and my expenses, principal, interest, taxes, insurance, and a little bit of my maintenance was covered 100% by the other 3
Boom.
Units. And so there we go.
Number one monthly expense covered.
Yeah. Covered, yeah. And I still had my old Toyota that I drove for like many years after that. So like I was living lean, very cheap, which allowed me to stay as an entrepreneur because it got rough. You know, it got rough. So I had a roller coaster. I'd do really well for a month and I'd lose money the next month. And that helped me kind of sustain that journey of not having to go back to a regular job. But anyone can use that. Like house hacking is amazing. I feel like it's if you're willing to do it, there's so many variations of that, but especially early in your career, you can use that as a kind of jumping off point into rental properties because you can move into the house with a smaller down payment. You can get a long-term loan because it's an owner-occupant property, and you can learn how to be a landlord. You can learn how to do it. If you make some mistakes, not a big deal. You're right there. And it was where I sort of learned how to do it and realized I could be a rental landlord. And we still own that property. That property that we bought,
nice.
It was worth $130,000 or $150,000 when we bought it. Now it's $250,000-$300,000, you know, so it's done well and it's making income, and it's still, we started doing a bunch more of those after that.
Yeah, that's what I love about house hacking is that it addressed, like at the core of that is, are you willing to do something that most folks aren't willing to do in order to get ahead financially?
Yeah.
It's just an alternative way of living, and to a certain extent, that's what it is. That's what it takes to be a small-time landlord. It's just approaching the issue of housing from a slightly different angle.
And it can be like, you think of it as an investment, but it's also putting a roof over your head, reducing your costs every month. I mean, it's got that
killer
double whammy going.
It's amazing. Yeah, so Chad, like, what is it right now that you're looking for? Like, when you're looking for a property, what are the factors that you're considering? Like, is it all about the numbers or other considerations that you're keeping in mind?
Yeah, I learned early on, I used to think it was all about the numbers, and the numbers are important. Like, and I'll talk a little bit about just some basic ways to run the numbers. But now that I've matured a little bit, I've realized that it's sort of like a two sides of a coin. Like a good deal, it has to have some numbers that make sense. So cash flow is a certain type of analysis you can do. You want a certain amount of cash flow, or you want it to cover your mortgage and then have a certain amount of money over that mortgage. But you also want to have a certain type of location, because you know, the money you make in real estate is sort of the consequence. It's the outcome. income. But the cause of that, like the core principle of real estate investing, is providing housing for someone. So someone's going to live there. Like, and so the location they live in, the type of property they live in, like those are so critical. And I had a mentor early in my career who told me, he said, Chad, you always want to buy properties that have some sort of romance to them. And I was like, romance? Like, what do you mean romance? Like, what are you talking about? And his point was, like, real estate is an emotional, either a purchase or if you're renting a property, it's an emotional thing. Like, you're living there for an emotional reason. And yes, you have to have a roof over your head. But if you don't have a property that has some sort of romance to it, meaning, and it could be something simple. It could be like, you know, you guys, I resonate with you that we like walkable locations. Like, we like a place with a yep. sidewalk and, you know, big trees, and you can walk to a local coffee shop. Like, that's romance. Like, that idea for someone that they could walk somewhere, for a certain type of person, that's romance. For another yep. type of person, it might mean, hey, I want to live close to where I work, but I want to live out with a 2-acre parcel in the country. And that's my idea of romance. But the principle is the same, is that you need to buy your properties with that in mind, like number one. And if you do that, like if you buy properties that are in demand because there's an emotional attraction to them for some reason, then the money stuff will take care of itself. Just for example, I have a single family house that we used to live in. And every time I put it on the market to rent, I put it on Zillow. And within a week, I have at least 5, sometimes 10 applications from people who want to rent the property. And this is at market rent. I'm not putting it way below market rent, like just a little bit below market rent. And I get to choose like the best, most qualified tenant, and they mm-hmm. tend to stay a long time as well. And why is that? That is because that property has romance. That property is in a neighborhood that's attractive. It's close to things that people want to be at. And so like that principle is something I missed early in my career. I bought some properties with good numbers on paper, but they were in the wrong location. And so you need to control the things you can control, which is where the property is. You can't move that house, at least can't do it easily. So you want to pick a good location first, and then yes, learn how to run the numbers, make sure the financing works, make sure we can talk about that too. But I think if you get that idea of location and then a good property that has a good layout, a lot of the other stuff will take care of itself.
Well, that can also reduce the hassle, right? Hassle factor, which is one of the biggest reasons that people say, yeah, real estate, I don't think that's for me. And I think also location can matter, not just in the monthly cash flow, but also when it comes to appreciation of that property.
Yes.
But talk to me about passive income, Chad. I feel like it's sold one way on the internet. Passive income is like a buzzword that people use to get people to follow them and try to yeah. talk to them about, hey, here's how you can like generate thousands of dollars a month in passive income. It's so easy. Follow me. But real estate is, sure, you can get passive income over time, but you're also talking about a part-time job, right?
Yeah, it is a part-time job, especially early on. I mentioned earlier, it starts off like a startup company, like a, you know, little venture capital startup company. So it's going to take some time and effort up front. And I call that like your psychological down payment. Like if you're not willing to like put that effort and that time in up front, real estate's not your thing. And that's fine. There's other options. There's index funds. And sometimes it's just the practical reason. If you have a job that is taking like 60 hours of your week, and having an hour of mental energy on some other venture would like tip you over the edge. Like you don't need to do real estate like that.
You don't have time for it.
Yeah, you don't have time. That's cool. Like maybe you will next year. Maybe you will another time in your life. It requires some effort up front, and you either need to spend time on negotiating properties, on running the numbers, on finding good locations, on building a team. Like that's where you're going to spend your time up front. Now, but the thing is, like I mentioned earlier, is that it eventually becomes passive though. And real estate's pretty cool in that way, is that you put that psychological down payment, you put that financial down payment, and then you stabilize that property, you get a good tenant. I've had tenants who stay for 10 years or more in some properties. And when that happens,
like, dream.
It's a dream.
Yeah. The dream.
It doesn't happen every day, but like it happens. And if it does, like think about how little work you have to do on a property if there's no turnover, if they're yeah. not moving. Yes, if something breaks, you have to fix it. But when I was in Spain, I would have something break. Even the properties I was self-managed, and my tenant had a plumber's phone number. They could call the plumber. Like they could say, hey, here's my plumber. I really like this plumber. Call them. I'll pay for it. But go ahead and call them if it's a problem. And if it's, you know, if that gets out of whack and they're spending money, too much money, I can try to, you know, change that policy. But it doesn't have to be a really huge time suck. And you can do it from anywhere in the world as long as you have a cell phone. And so that's where the end game of real estate is, that it can be very passive. But it also, that key word that I mentioned earlier, it's also recurring. This recurring income, it's a lot like your salary. And so like you used to having that monthly salary, and that's a nice thing to have, and real estate can replace that. It can be very much like that.
I like that. I've never given my tenants the number of the plumber before, but that's a little trick. I might have to steal from you.
But I realize
until you get a bill and you realize that like they have them install like a bidet or something. And
I remember being like 6 hours away one time, and there was a water issue at one of my rentals, and I was like, usually I was used to going over there when there was an issue, just to scope it out, get a lay of the land, and that was the first time I realized I just called the plumber. He took care of it. Because I was still out of town, and the light went off in my brain.
Need to go over there.
I don't even know that I ever have to go over there again, which is kind of crazy. I mean, I still like to go check on it, see it once or twice a year, kind of thing. But like, it's one of those things where over time I've been able to become less and less active, and I just remember that being this like aha, wow, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that I didn't have to be this complete active participant all the time in the property.
Exactly. You know, that's the benefit that some people who invest long distance have over those of us who started local, is that you have to treat it as a business from the very beginning. Like, you, if you're in San Francisco and you're buying a property in Georgia, like you can't go look at it. Sorry. Like, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And so it forces you to think like a business owner, as opposed to, and there's nothing wrong with going to the property and checking it out. Like, I'm all for that, especially when you're learning, especially when you're growing, especially when you're trying to save money. Like, that's cool. Like, there's nothing wrong with it. But eventually, like, I think this is what I wrote about in the book, about, I have a whole chapter on systems. Like, you should think kind of like Henry Ford did when he built the Model T and built the assembly line. Like, that for him, the process of building a car became the thing that he worked on. It became the thing he tinkered with. And you, as a real estate investor, should think about your business as this is like a kind of like a machine, kind of like an engine, and you have to tinker with it. And you're not just working in your business, you're actually working on your business, trying to create systems and processes and building a team. And if you do that, that's where the good stuff happens on the other end. That's where you can have the benefit of the income. And yes, you're gonna have to pay somebody to manage it sometimes. You're gonna have to pay a plumber who might charge more than you. But if you treat it like a business, you run the numbers so that you can pay people to do those things for you. And your profit as the owner of that business is what's left over after you pay all those other people to do those things.
It also just comes down to what it is that you're optimizing for. Like, we kind of touched on that there earlier, but like, it makes me think about, you said you've had tenants that have been around for 10 years, and I'm guessing you were less likely to raise the rent dramatically on that tenant, because if they were a good tenant, you probably wanted to keep them in there. Now, were you optimizing for the amount of cash flow that you had by doing that? No, probably not. But you were optimizing for what it is that you were seeking. This is like the whole like building wealth versus achieving some sense of freedom that you talk about. But is that true?
It is true. Yeah. Well, somebody's been there 10 years. I mean, it's automatically below the market. And that's not to say we don't raise the rents. Like, we do raise it some. But I'll give you a practical example. I've got a property where the tenant was willing to renew, or I sent an email or a text saying, hey, we'd like to renew. The market rent right now is $1,800 per month, or maybe it's market rent's $2,000 per month. They were paying like $1,550 per month. Like, this, the rents had gone really up really fast. And we said, we need to raise the rent some. Our insurance is going up, okay, maintenance expenses are going up, but we're not going to raise it up to the market level. We need to raise it by $50 per month. And so that's the kind of, you know, they're still getting a better deal than they could if they had to move somewhere else, but we're covering our costs. But I know landlords who don't ever raise the rents at all. And that's your choice. And that's a different choice than like, if you were an institutional landlord, which you guys know, I'm kind of like hot on trying to say how small and mighty investors I think are much better for communities than these big institutional Wall Street landlords.
We're with you on that too. Yeah.
their job is to maximize their return for their investors. And they're gonna push the rent to market as much as they can over and over again.
Often at the expense of the tenant.
Exactly, yes. And so I feel like it's not, the landlord-tenant relationship is often put as an adversarial relationship, but I very, very rarely felt that with my tenants. Like, I felt like I'm providing value to them, giving them a nice home that we care about and we have pride in. We're not slumming that property out. We wanna treat it well, we wanna treat the tenant well. And they're, in return, they're paying rent and they're maintaining the house as if it was their own. They're taking care of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I, during COVID, was one of the biggest aha moments for me. Was like, I read in the newspapers on Wall Street Journal and all this about how so many tenants weren't paying and how adversarial the landlord-tenant relationship was. 99.9% of our tenants were still paying on time. A couple of them had issues and we worked it out. They took care of the properties. Like, they appreciated having a home to live in, and I appreciated them. And it was, I had never been so grateful in my life for our tenants. And I hope they were also grateful for the home they had, because it's a mutually beneficial relationship. It doesn't have to be something that we're beating each other up about.
Yeah, Matt and I had similar experiences. Let's talk about debt and financing for a second, Chad. I mean, rising interest rates, of course, we've been talking about those over the past, 18 months or whatever. But how have those changed your advice to wannabe real estate investors? Have rising rates maybe tamped down your enthusiasm for small, mighty real estate investing?
It's just changed the approach. It's changed the technique. And the way I compare it, the last, we're here in 2023 when we did this interview, 2018 through 2022, and even before that, this has been an unusual time historically in terms of interest rates, in terms of real estate investing, where you could actually go out and get a 2 or 3% mortgage, pay retail price almost for a house, and have it cash flow. Like that, I just want to put it in perspective. Like, that is unusual. Like, that's not the normal thing. That's not to say that it wasn't good, like good for us. Like, great, you got to take advantage. But the way we real estate investors, we always have to pivot. We always have to change. We always have to adapt to the market. And I'm going to break the real estate investing into two pieces. Like, one piece is not changed at all. I don't care what the interest rates are. The fundamentals of those good locations that we talked about earlier, the fundamentals of finding good tenants, the fundamentals of maintenance, those things are the same. The challenge, the other piece that we have to look at now, is the cost of buying a property with a traditional financing mortgage has gone from 3 or 4% up to 7%. And what that does is that makes the cost of using debt much more expensive, at least going to the bank and using debt. So how do we solve that? One way is you could put more money down because your cash flow is not working as well with a small down payment. You might have to figure out a way to either go in with a partner or save up more money. Maybe you have to slow down a little bit, buy fewer properties. And I've told people, if you've already owned a few properties and you have enough money to even pay cash for a property, you're essentially getting a 7% return instead of paying the bank 7%. If you were in that kind of later stage of your career where you're I don't know that I want to pay the 3% debt off, but I could pay cash for a new property or put 50% down or something, the cash flow can work when you make a bigger down payment. And I'm not saying that's what everybody should do, but that's option A. You can make it cash flow by putting a larger down payment. Option B is getting creative with your financing. And the way I explain this is you can look at your financing like a toolbox. And if you're building a house, you'd have 5 or 6 or 10 tools in your toolbox or more, right? Well, when you're financing houses, you don't want to just have one hammer. That's what traditional financing is. I just got a hammer. I'm just going to use the hammer over and over and over again. Well, no, why wouldn't you use a screwdriver and a saw and these other tools? And what those other tools are thinking outside the box, talking to the seller and seeing if the seller will finance the property for you. It's called seller financing. It's not common. It's not typical when you go through a real estate agent that the seller's just going to say, yes, I'd love to finance the property to you. No, it's a little different approach. You might have to reach out directly to the seller. You might have to look for landlords or people who are more predisposed to finance properties to you. The ideal person to finance a property is a landlord who's owned a property for 15, 20, 30 years, and they're kind of tired of the landlording business and they're ready to exit, but they like that recurring income. Remember that monthly income, and they've gotten used to that. But
they're addicted to it.
I'm addicted as well. I get it. Yeah. But then they don't want to manage the day-to-day affairs. Maybe they're getting up in years. And so them financing to you might be the perfect solution for them. That's the way they can exit the property. And so that's one tool in your toolbox. You could also use private money. The number one way I finance my deals over the years is going to other investors, and they would have a self-directed retirement account, or they would set up a retirement account that had money that they could actually loan to me as a real estate investor. And that's not something a lot of people know about, but if you have your own IRA that you can choose where it's at, or if you have a 401k at an old employer, for example, there's some flexibility on the custodians you can put that with. And so that strategy for me was I had a professor at Clemson University, and he had a lot of money in a retirement account, and he has some of it in the stock market, but I taught him how, hey, you could loan me that $100,000 and I could pay you 7% interest or 10% interest or 6%, whatever the interest rate you negotiate. And so you can show other people how they can be your bank, basically be your private bank, or you can meet other investors at local meetups who would like to do that. They like to get interest. And so those are just a couple of examples. But the point is, like, if you think outside the box, this is what real estate investors have had to do for decades. You're going to have to hustle a little bit. You're going to have to think outside the box a little bit and learn a few different techniques to make it work.
Yeah. Again, it comes back to how willing are you to do the things that other folks aren't necessarily willing to do? You got to be willing to do things slightly unconventionally in order to get the deal.
All right, we want to talk about deleveraging as well. That's kind of part of shoring up your real estate portfolio. We'll talk about that, and then just kind of like how to get started maybe as well. We'll get to a couple more questions with Chad right after this.
Kachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Kachava really earns their 52,000 plus five-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in five delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Kachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Kachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the AM in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Kachava. Just go to kachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's kachava.com/howtomoney. Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Joel, longer days and warmer weather, it means our family is spending a lot more time outside. It's great. Like, literally yesterday, I was in the front yard, Kate was in the garden, and I was kicking the soccer ball around with a couple of the kids. I'm loving it. But something else that you can do for your family this spring, shopping for life insurance with Policy Genius as part of your financial planning for the year. Kate and I both have policies in place, and that means we have peace of mind so that if something were to happen to either of us, our family can cover expenses while getting back on our feet.
Yeah, with Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Even if you already have a life insurance policy through work, by the way, it may not have enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. On top of that, Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies. That means they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another, so you can trust their guidance.
That's right. So save time and money and provide your family with a financial safety net using Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. All right, we are back from the break talking still with Chad Carson about how you can be a small and mighty real estate investor. And Chad, Joel, he kind of alluded to this right before the break, but deleveraging. When and how should folks out there pay down debt on a rental property? Because like you said earlier as well, it kind of goes against the traditional advice. The traditional approach of most real estate investors, you want to hang on to that leverage as long as possible, but you have done that before. You pay down debt, but you've also sold properties. Can you talk about when and why you would do that?
Yeah, I think about your real estate investing as a journey, essentially. So like I mentioned the mountain metaphor. Like when you first start as a new investor, you're sort of at the bottom of the mountain and you're going to use certain techniques and strategies when you're new. Like you probably don't have a lot of capital, you need more money. And so you just try to use as much debt as you can early on. Like if you did a house hack, put 5% down on a property, like, awesome. Like, that's what you should do early on, because you just got to get your foot in the game. So, but that's the approach of a starter. And then you move out of the starter phase into what I call like the wealth builder phase. And your whole goal as a wealth builder is turning whatever capital, whatever money, whatever wealth you have, let's say you have $100,000, turn that $100,000 into $1 million. Like, your goal is to grow. And you want to do it safely, right? You want to get up that mountain, and using leverage makes a lot of sense in that case as well. So you might reinvest all the cash you make from your rental. Like, don't touch that money, put it back into buying the next rental property and the next rental property. So that's like, those are the first two stages. But I feel like most real estate investors get stuck in phase number two. Like, all the techniques are talking about just grow. It's like, well, do you just grow forever? Or like, do you get into this perpetual debt religion and like never pay debt off? Like, you know, what happens? And what most people assume, going back to like the typical model, is you just buy more properties. And what I advocate is, like, when you finally get to this point where you have, like, you can measure your wealth, and you say, let's just say you had $1 million, then why not start taking some of those chips off the table by plowing back some of the profits you have, either the cash flow from your rentals, or you could even, like, let's say you bought 13 properties and you only needed 10, like, why not sell a couple of your properties, pay taxes on what you sold the property for, and then plow that money back into paying off the debt on a couple of properties. Now, stick with me. If you've never heard somebody say you should do this, like, my business partner and I has sort of stumbled into this, but we were lucky enough to have like $100,000 in our bank account. We're like, I've never had this happen before. This is amazing. Like, where did this money come from? It was because we had been saving our cash flow. We sold a property and this money was sitting there, and we looked at one of our debts. It was an older debt that we'd been paying for like 10 years. It was $1,000 per month. And the property had appreciated to like $250,000, $300,000. And so we had a lot of equity in the property. But we looked at that payment, we're like, we could spend $100,000 and go buy 4 more rental properties and keep growing, or we could pay off this debt and free up $1,000 per month. $1,000 per month is $12,000 per year. And what would we do there? We'd have $12,000 per year in cash flow. That's like you could think about that as like a 12% cash on cash return. We would not have to grow anymore. So we wouldn't have any more properties with more tenants and more headaches and more, you know, heating and air units. And we would simplify our life. We'd increase our cash flow. And we'd also decrease our risk, because having debt is great. It's a great tool for growing. But if things go badly, if you get in a big recession, if you have a great, you know, depression like we had in the 1930s, having debt could really put you upside down. Like, you could owe more than what the property's worth. The rents could go down. I mean, that doesn't happen. It's probably not going to happen. Like, I don't think it's going to happen. But just when you start getting towards the top of the mountain, when you're climbing, it makes more sense to, like, thinking about not just growing, also thinking about income, also thinking about simplicity. So I feel like that's the stage where it makes sense to start paying off debt. Now, whether you pay off 100% of your debt or you pay off like a few properties, you know, we've kind of gone through that over the years. We still have some debt on our portfolio, but instead of having like 60, 70% of our value of our portfolio in debt, we have more like 15% or 20% right now. And eventually we'll be at 0%, but like we're feeling pretty good about where we are right now.
Yeah, you're sitting pretty. And even if, let's say, that there were some predictions of like another 2008 sort of housing recession, I don't see that on the horizon. But if housing prices dip, like, and you're over leveraged and your tenant isn't paying or whatever, like, that puts you in a bind, and you're not in that bind, right? Even if your tenant or multiple tenants don't pay, you're still fine. And so there's like a mental ease that creates, I think. Yeah. What would you say, Chad, to the folks maybe who've made it this far into the conversation? They're maybe fascinated by the wealth building possibilities of real estate, but they're also hesitant to get going because it seems risky. It sounds risky. Like, I don't know, maybe I should just keep tossing money into my 401k. And again, we talk about that all the time. We're totally down. Get the match. Like, don't forsake that. Real estate investing should be after you've done that, at least. But what would you say to somebody who's like, I don't think that's for me? But it's not necessarily because I don't have the time or don't have the desire. It's just it sounds like it's too much.
Yeah, I would say just take it one step at a time. Like, you don't have to make a forever decision with real estate investing. You can test it out. You can buy one property and that might be enough. Like, you might just buy one property, take a break for a year or two, let it season, take a deep breath, see if that was a good decision or not. And then you can do another one after that. And I actually have a mentor named John Schaub, who's a guy I've followed for a long time. He's been investing in real estate for 50 years. He wrote his book that I always loved was called Building Wealth One House at a Time. just one house. Like, he just recommends buying one house a year, one property a year. And if you do that, like if you just continue buying, just like the tortoise, not the hare, just plodding along, it seems pretty small in the beginning. It seems like you're not making much progress, but that can build an enormous momentum. But it also, if you think it's a mistake, if you get into the game, you're like, I bought a property or two, this is not for me. You can sell the properties or you can get out of them. It's not going to happen overnight. Real estate isn't as easy to sell as a piece of stock. But if you buy it correctly and you don't overstretch yourself and you're careful with it, it's not going to be a disastrous decision. Like, going slowly, thinking about it, being deliberate allows you to kind of get your feet back under you again. And you can pivot, you can change. But I have a hunch, like if you kind of liked real estate and you got into it, you might just get addicted to it like I have, like Joel and Matt has, because it's got a lot of good stuff to it as well. And some of the negative stuff you hear up front is it talks people out of real estate, but real estate over the long run can have so many benefits, and I'm experiencing those now. And one of the reasons I get out on podcasts and appreciate you guys having me is because I like to talk about it. I like to talk about the good sides of it and how if you get through the tough stuff up front, the other side of that can be an amazing change in your life. It gives you freedom. It gives you flexibility. And I've experienced that myself.
It takes a while. There's like a lot of stuff you need to learn when you're thinking about becoming a real estate investor. One thing Matt and I, we've done a whole episode on screening tenants properly, because we think that is like 90% of the issues that you're going to face are not having screened a tenant thoroughly. And so if you do that, you're way ahead of the ball game. You're going to deal with far fewer of the issues that a lot of other landlords have to endure. But I love what you said too, one house at a time. That's a great strategy. It makes me think of like an athlete post game saying, I'm just taking one game at a time. And sometimes that just, and you know, Chad, you know this, you probably gave those interviews at a post football game, right?
I did, yes.
You have to say that, but the truth is, when you take it one house at a time, one game at a time, when your focus is just on the next step, you're much more likely to be successful than thinking about this bigger overarching goal you're looking to achieve over time. It's like you got to take it one play at a time, one game at a time, one house at a time. That's how you're going to be successful.
Yeah, you opened up the sports metaphor, so I'm gonna go there as well real quick.
Oh, bring it. But, yeah, come on. Bring it.
So like one of my favorite coaches in sports is a guy named John Wooden. He was a basketball coach at UCLA, and he used to bring he had the best players in the country. He had like Bill Walton, who's a Hall of Famer. He had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and he would bring these players in before the season started, and he would spend a whole day, like, or 2 hours, sitting in a room, practicing, putting on their socks and tying their shoes. Literally, wow. Like they would have them tying their shoes. And so you just imagine this all American. How frustrating would it be? Like, why am I doing this, coach? Like, I put my shoes on like 10 times. Like, what is this? And he would get them frustrated. And he would say, you know why we're doing this? Is because this is something we can control. This is a part of the process of being a good basketball player. It's a tiny little piece, tiny little step. But if you have a wrinkle in your sock, or if you tie your shoe wrong, you're probably going to get a blister. If you get a blister, you're going to miss practice. If you miss practice, we're not going to play well in the game. And if we don't play well in the game, we're not going to win a championship, or we're not going to do all those things that you want to do. And real estate investing is the same way. The little tiny baby steps are what matters. So tenant screening, I'm 100% on board. Like, if you're going to own properties, you got to learn how to screen your tenants. You got to learn how to have an application. You got to learn how to have those conversations. Like, the little tiny, what seem like tiny steps, they matter a lot. And in real estate, the part of the upfront cost of real estate is learning what matters and what doesn't, and what, you know, location matters. I mentioned that earlier. Screening tenants matters, and there's a bunch of other stuff in that matter too. But like, if you get the financing matters, and so if you figure out like the 3, 4, 5 things that really matter the most, and you put your socks on, you tie your shoes well, and you do it consistently, one deal at a time, the end result of that is a equivalent of a championship. Like, you will do better, and you'll be kind of surprised by it. Like, you know, that's the big athletes. I've seen athletes who are putting for like the winning the British Open, and they're kind of surprised by it. Like, whoa, wait a minute, like, what, I just won the British Open? It's because they were like paying attention to their putt. They're paying attention to the process. Yeah. That's what an athlete does. That's what a real estate investor does as well.
Yeah, it almost surprises you that you've done well, but it's no surprise, actually, because you've taken all the right steps all along the way. It's why we love your approach. Chad, where is it that folks out there can find your new book, and how can folks learn more about what it is that you've got going on?
Yeah, well, thank you again for having me, guys. And the book is out on Bigger Pockets. That's my publisher. That's a big publishing website and real estate investing website. But I know we'll have links in the show notes and different places, but if you go to biggerpockets.com/smallandmighty, that is where you can get it. It'll also be available the 22nd of August on Amazon. Amazon, on Audible. So anywhere else you get your books. Bigger Pockets is a pretty cool place to get it because I actually wrote some extra bonuses. Like I wrote a bonus chapter about being a small and mighty investor in a changing economy, talking about these rising interest rates and different the way things are changing. How do you adjust? So some of what we talked about today. Wherever you get the book, I would love it. I'd love to hear from you once you buy the book and read it. You know, I'm all over the place online. If you just search for Coach Carson on Instagram, on other places, on my podcast, like I'm out there. Just search for Coach Carson and let me know that you liked it. Let me know that any feedback you have, because I wrote this book as a passion project. Like this was an itch I had in my head, and I want to see tons and tons of people buy that one property, that two properties, and have success with it. And my reward for that is like getting to hear your stories.
Yeah, that's great. Also, well, I'm imagining a lot of How to Money listeners are very interested in that, given kind of what we've talked about with real estate over the years, and this book really is the one to get for sure in our minds if you're looking to get into real estate or if you're just curious. So, Chad, thanks again so much for joining us today on the show, man. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you, guys.
All right, man. It's always a good day if we can sit down and talk with our bud, Chad Carson.
Almost makes it feel not like work because...
It really doesn't. Yeah. Dude, we're so fortunate to be able to do what it is we do. I mean, like literally to be drinking craft beer, talking about money, talking about real estate, talking with friends as well.
Yeah.
We've got a good...
Made in the shade, baby.
I'm incredibly fortunate for what it is that we do here at How to Money, but specifically to real estate, the small and mighty real estate investor. What is it today that stood out to you? What was your big takeaway?
Yeah, so... I love kind of the beginning of the episode where we're talking about how to work backwards from the life you want. And that's so powerful because if you don't know that, you might be tempted to overindulge, to go so hard and then look up after that nose to the grindstone real estate portfolio building escapade you've been on and be like, huh, why? Why did I do that? Because now I'm so locked in. I'm working way more than I want to. And yeah, granted, I have this awesome real estate portfolio to show for it, but I've missed out on a lot of the important things along the way. And so I think, Chad, we just jive so much on all of those levels when it comes to
lifestyle and what is it that we're pursuing. Keeping the end in mind.
It's possible to overdo it.
Yeah, it's possible to overdo it and to be too... financially savvy with the different moves that you're making. Yeah. And starting with the end goal in mind is so important. I completely agree with you. And so my big takeaway is going to be when we kind of touched on interest rates, mortgage interest rates, and how I think the natural tendency might be for individuals to find themselves attracted to more and more properties that may not necessarily fit the bill. They might be looking further out or neighborhoods that aren't quite as promising. And it's in order to achieve the numbers that we were able to find 5-10 years ago, right? And Chad, he specifically, at some point, I forget what it is that we even asked him about, but he was talking about the romance of a location and how you can't discount that. You can't calculate that on paper, but it's something that you feel, it's something that you see, and you can kind of write down and be like, oh, well, it's walkable, or oh, it's close to this park, or it's close to this brewery, oh, it's got a front porch, different things that you know to certain individuals might appeal to them, but don't discount those things, because again, you might be looking at, if you are a real estate investor, you might be looking at some of these other properties that on paper, okay, this should make sense, but you have to look beyond, you know, capitalization rate. You have to look beyond, can I pull in 1% of the purchase price of this home? It's not just about the numbers. You got to take all those other things into account as well.
No, I mean, it makes me think, the question I've always asked when I'm buying a property is, would I live in this place? And would I be happy to live here? Mm-hmm. And so if the answer to that is no, then I'm not interested, right? If I'm, whether it's based on location, based on like the yard, based on the way the home looks, I want it to be like cute and just if it doesn't have all those factors and if I wouldn't be willing to live in it myself or at least 25-26 year old Joel wouldn't be willing to live in it, then I'm not interested.
Makes it tougher to list that property and really believe in it.
Exactly. I love the location, if I love the neighborhood and it's the disc golf course is right around the corner, my favorite brewery is right over here, then when I'm talking to tenants, that enthusiasm comes through. Mm-hmm. And I think especially if they don't know about the neighborhood, now they know, right? I'm almost like a tour guide of my neighborhood sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
When I'm telling people
about
it. Well,
that's a big part of touting the different benefits of that specific property. But all right. Well, let's shift to the beer. During this episode, we enjoyed a Zeros to Heaven. This is a West Coast IPA by, so apropos, Casa Agria. Casa, that means house. So
look at you, your fancy Spanish. Chad would be so proud.
He would be.
His wife would be too, who's a Spanish teacher.
What? Yeah, did you like this beer?
I did. So I'm not usually a West Coast IPA guy.
This wasn't super West Coasty.
But it wasn't, yeah. It was really interesting. It wasn't, I feel like a lot of West Coast IPAs, they're bitter to the max. But this one was clean. Yeah, it had those piney notes, but it wasn't over the top pithy bitterness. And so this one was like a balanced West Coast. And
it was super juicy. Not overly sweet, but super juicy. It had some of these other notes going on versus just sort of the harsh bitterness that you can expect oftentimes with West Coast IPAs. But yeah, totally agree. Very drinkable. Glad you and I got to enjoy this one here on the show.
From one of the best breweries on the West Coast.
It's a good one. We'll make sure to link to where it is that you can find Chad's book up on the website at howtomoney.com. But that's going to be it, buddy, for this one. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.
Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're really choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers.
Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies.
Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.